so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
The less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Show, Canada's only radio program on podcast on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is Friday, November 2nd, 2018 on CFRO 100.5 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. For the next hour, I'm your host, Jen, and I'm joined in studio today by my co-host, Allison Cole.
Hello there.
Happy birthday to you, Allison.
Thank you.
I just want to say I am so grateful to have met you in this life and to have you as a comrade in the animal rights movement. You've been such a great friend, and we need more people like you in this world. So thank you for existing.
We need more people like you as well, and like Carol, who's sitting here,
and
the people, our friends, who we spent the morning with today, which is coming up soon.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Just want to let you know that today's show is brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth and chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy, because on our big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. Today we're going to be speaking with a 38-year-old Vancouver local who has been vegetarian for his entire life and vegan for 21 years. Best known for his local business, plant-based food and natural products, David is, in my opinion, one of Vancouver's most influential and effective animal rights activists, with a relentless drive and endless knowledge on our local animal exploitation centers, such as the Vancouver Aquarium, pet stores, and the Greater Vancouver Zoo. Beyond this, David is one of the most generous people I know, regularly hosting free pop-up shops in the downtown east side, offering food, drinks, clothing, and personal care items for those in need. He's here today to speak with us about the animal trade industry as a former insider who dedicates his life to defending all oppressed beings. Stay tuned for that interview in about 10 minutes. And now, Allison, you and I attended an event today at Pacific Center Mall, downtown Vancouver. It was the grand opening of the Canada Goose flagship store.
Yes, I wanted to get my fur-lined jacket. I wanted to be the first one in the door, and we almost were, weren't we?
Yeah.
But I think we're going to play a little clip to show what happened.
Can I have everyone's attention? The Canada Goose symbol is known for its cold climate, but it represents anything but warmth. The fur trim is lined with fur from wild coyotes who are trapped and then killed and skinned. This is a step-by-step process by which coyotes are trapped, left to languish, and then killed so that the skin can be stitched into jackets. Wild coyotes are caught in any of the following: steel leg trap, head crushing trap, body crushing trap, and neck snares. Especially the mothers. They even attempt to shoot off their own limbs so they can escape. If none of these kill the coyotes, the trappers will shoot them and strangle them, stomp on them, and bludgeon them to death. It's not just coyotes who are trapped. Dogs, cats, birds, and other animals are also killed by these traps.
Keep going. Angel, keep going.
Their skin bodies are discarded as spotlessly as their lives are taken. Every piece of fur trim came from an animal who didn't want to die. Canada Goose is the product of cruelty! And it's not just coyotes that are killed. They also use feathers from ducks and geese. These birds, whose feathers are stuffed into the jacket, have an improperly stunned, which means they're still conscious. They're still conscious when their throats are cut and stuffed into
So just to give a little context to that speak out by one of our local animal rights activists, we lined up outside the Canada Goose store today for the grand opening, and Allison and I were witnessing on behalf of CFRO Radio what was going to be happening, and it became apparent that the security were quite aware of the group of activists, even though they were wearing plain clothes and were not really looking like activists. They knew they would be coming, and there was a lot of security all around the store, and you could see them whispering to one another and pointing out which ones they thought were activists. And so the activists had intended to go inside the store and then pull out some fabric banners that they had stuffed into their jackets, and upon realizing that wasn't going to happen, they ended up doing a speak out outside the store, which was quite effective. They lined up in front of the store with all of their fabric signs, talking about how cruel fur was, and then one of the activists that we heard there, Angel, gave that speak out.
Yes, and I found it very disturbing at how quickly and how much the security staff and the staff of Canada Goose, how quickly they wanted to shut this down. You know, there was that long lineup that they were slowly letting people into the store to go get their jackets. They're asking, oh, do you have a shopping list, or are you just browsing? And letting us know, like, okay, yeah, we're going to let you in one by one. And there were, would you say there were more than 20 people lined up or something?
About that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when they realized that this is happening now, and we're getting a message out to shame and put down their store, they quickly ushered everyone in, please go, please get in, buy cruelty, you don't need to hear this, you don't need to hear that fur is murder and death, and that's day one.
And also, there are a lot of stores in the vicinity in this section of the mall that sell fur, and one of the staff members came out from the store across the hall,
Harry Rosen,
and basically said something like, we don't want to hear what you have to say, which you could have heard in the audio clip that we just played. So, yeah, it's fur is making a comeback. It's really sad to see, but it really is.
Well, I'm just really surprised that they opened this store here in Vancouver, in a place that is supposed to be, you know, liberally minded. And we have on the West Coast, West Hollywood, and Los Angeles now, and San Francisco. No more fur. You would think that Vancouver would be the next one to ban, and that they wouldn't invest.
We need to grow this movement. There's over 7,000 people in a Facebook group called Vancouver Vegans, and hardly any of them do any activism. And imagine the change we could make if we had more people helping out on these kinds of campaigns. So let's switch gears right now. This is the week that we had a lot of fireworks because of Halloween, and I want to talk about the impact on animals. So I actually went to Facebook and I asked people to post their stories of how their animals reacted to fireworks on New Year's Eve, and I'm just going to read some of them. Erica says, my aunt's dog had epilepsy and had seizures almost every time, especially during New Year's Eve. Even though they stayed inside, the dog would get really stressed out and start licking everything and whimper. If someone used fireworks on days they weren't allowed to use fireworks, the same thing would happen. It really scared the dog, and she got stressed and was at risk of getting more seizures. If she had several seizures during a limited time, the dog would get really exhausted physically, and that would put them at risk of even more. Trish says, a few years ago, my sister's horse and two others got loose and were tearing frantically down some of the main roads on Gabriola Island. These are dark, windy streets at nighttime, so very dangerous even for traffic. Many animals react with fight or flight once they are feeling endangered. Leslie says, my dog was shaking and drooling, ended up giving him a tranquilizer, which I don't like to do. It knocks him right out. I feel sad for the wildlife and wish they would ban fireworks. Another Leslie said, I live in Tawasin, and a few years back, my family's beloved dog was spooked by fireworks and he ran away. The family was heartbroken, put up posters and ads in papers. There were sightings of him, but he was never found again. And this is really common. I've heard so many stories of animals never being found again. I've heard stories of former SPCA staff members who've said that they have to spend the next day trying to get dogs out of the streets that have run away scared.
And we shared a very tragic story that happened in Vancouver here a couple years ago.
I was crying during that interview.
Yeah,
that was a woman
too,
whose dog got scared by fireworks and ran from an off-leash park onto the tracks of the SkyTrain. And although the SkyTrain was temporarily stopped to try to get the dog removed, somebody made the call to start the train again, and it ran over her dog.
Yeah.
And so I've spoken with animal rights activist friends of mine who say that they oppose fireworks bans because they don't want vegans to be seen as no fun people. But when animals are dying, I think that is, it's very serious. And there's a bigger issue as well. There's people who suffer PTSD. There's people who are here from war-torn countries.
Yes. And there's wildlife too that people
wildlife.
Do not often think about.
Imagine them getting separated from each other, babies and mothers, and never coming
home. For me,
again.
What I think about is it's an egregious waste of money when we have other things that our city needs to be spending money on.
Absolutely.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
Today we're speaking with David Isbister, a Vancouver-based animal rights and social activist who dedicates his life to helping others and creating societal change. He's also the owner of a local vegan food and personal care product company, Plant-Based Food and Natural Products. He puts on regular fundraisers for the residents of the downtown east side and has been instrumental in convincing Vancouver's Park Board commissioners to ban cetacean captivity at the Vancouver Aquarium. David is here to speak with us about his experience working in the animal trade industry, as well as offer his thoughts on captivity, breeding, and animal exploitation for profit. Thanks for being on the show today, David.
Oh, thanks for having me in that overly generous bio. That was very kind of you.
You're definitely one of my favorites in this community. So why don't you begin by telling us your history in the pet trade industry? A lot of people would be surprised to hear that a vegan animal rights activist came from such a past. So how did that happen for you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think a few of us have come, you know, out of it maybe as young idealists. From perspective, I'm 38 now. I started working in pet stores even very, very young. My mom once had a job at Coquitlam Center, and I hung out at the pet store while she worked a lot of times when I was a kid. So it just naturally was sort of brought into me, like, this is where we go and interact with animals. So even being raised vegetarian and then being vegan, I kind of kept a lot of that, and it was idealism and even a bit of denying reality that allowed me to do that. Probably missed the entire point of your question there, but
a little bit, but I'll bring you back. I just wanted to know what kind of roles you took on and how long were you involved in this?
So I guess what was said to be some sort of a talent or gift or whatever silly thing they say to make you do work for them, for handling animals that were more aggressive or had different behavioral sort of challenges or presentations. So I tamed snakes and handled bugs and lizards, and mostly was like a care expert, a lay expert in the realm of mainly exotics, fish, reptile, birds. But I also did a bunch of stuff with sort of the conventional pet store animals, like dogs and cats. You just had to kind of know their care and whatnot as well. So.
Mm-hmm. So many people who purchase exotic animals may never consider how the animals got to our pet stores. Can you tell us about the collection of animals from the wild, breeding facilities, and transport?
Yeah, so I worked my way up to sort of be a manager of the section and was sort of sought out a little bit within the pet trade community to order reptiles and house them. And so there were two main suppliers at that time, and they would list animals you know, ball python captive hatched, which means that the eggs were taken from the wild and then hatched in an incubator in like a warehouse in another country and then shipped this way or in their home country. Sometimes you'd see generally wild caught. And you just kind of were expected to just assume that that's the way it was and do your best for them once they arrived, if they arrived.
Yeah, and I mean, you said that you were doing the ordering. Were you aware of what countries these animals were coming from and how exactly they were arriving here, by ship or plane?
No. You had to get pretty deep into it to know that. You'd hear, and then gradually over time you'd start to piece it together when you saw other lists and other animals from other places, you know, when you get sent, other people's advertising, you know, someone out of the home country, and you realize it's the same supplier as the other person you're dealing with here in Canada, you know, just importing them. So you were able to piece it together over time, which was really shocking to me. And also just the deplorable conditions that they're kept in as they arrive here, you know, en route.
Yeah. What countries are a lot of the iguanas and lizards coming from, for example?
It depends in a lot of different ways. Like the home country of the lizards, of all these different reptiles, is so vast. But iguanas come from Central and South America for the most part. It's hard to pin down one country. Basically, any country with insufficient animal protection laws is a good start. There are often places that you see a lot of reptiles like that come from. But even animals protected on CITES 1 and 2 coming into Canada, they're laced at that time anyway, 10, 15 years ago, that the pet stores and the brokers were able to constantly skirt those regulations.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was doing some reading up in preparation for this interview, and I mean, I've read these kinds of things before, but I kind of forgot. I was reading about how a lot of animals are arriving at airports and being busted by customs officials, and there are parrots stuffed into cut open plastic pop bottles, and they've got their feet bound together with tape so that they can't try to get out. And they're like this for days or weeks sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely horrifying. And I saw some absolutely, to this day, just regrettable stomach churning stuff with how animals are packed. And it was always, you know, supported with something to the effect of, oh, they've got to be packed like that for their safety or air pressure or some sort of pseudo-scientific explanation that in the end you realize was just about the sender saving shipping costs and making more profit on the order.
Yeah, and I was actually reading that about 80 to 90% of these animals are arriving dead because of the way that they're packed with no food or water.
Well, I mean, in my case, several times over, I got entire cases of animals that were left on a tarmac in 40 plus degree Celsius weather and had overheated to the point where I got a box, essentially, content warning. It's not a great description, but a box essentially of sad, exploded, grotesque bodies, you know, bleeding, and some of them packed together, and who had attacked each other inside of the tiny little enclosure to try and save themselves. Just a horrible box of carnage, and the number, not to mention all the animals I saw die in supposedly expert-type facilities, even, you know, puppies dying from, the whole kennels of puppies dying from parvo and other manageable illnesses. So the trade as a whole is horrible, but exotics do especially get a horrible treatment because they're more discreet. They have different needs, and some of those needs can be exploited in order to hide them or at least obfuscate, like, the true intent, you know, the true intent why they're sending them that way and how they're packing them and how they're capturing them. It's really just altogether quite sad.
You were telling me that at one of the facilities you worked at, there was meant to be a check 3 times a day for the dead bodies in the cages and the tanks.
That is, that's totally standard procedure for when you work in a fish room. I worked in a number of fish rooms, and they all do that. It's the dead fish check, and you go around 3 times a day so that customers see less of the fish that die. I also work for the people that import the fish and bring them in. You know, as I was trying to figure out my place in this horrible industry and understand, like, why, you know, people didn't want to have the same intention that I had. You know, obviously this was naive on my part. They, you know, any exploitation of animals is wrong, and I was trying to exploit animals the right way. I just didn't quite have the experience to know that that's what I was doing. I thought I was was trying to help, but yeah, it's just, I could go on and on about the fish as well. You know, they bring in hundreds and hundreds of fish, and you know, dozens would survive, and those ones would get sent out, and it was just a numbers game. And that's how it was discussed. It wasn't even like this was all by accident on their end. The higher up you get along the ordering chain or the management chain, the more you realize that the overall strategy is just to get as many animals paid for before they die, and then keep people coming back to care for their animals or replace them with other animals.
Well, speaking of the fish, in my research, I found that a lot of the fish are obtained by underwater explosives to get them to come out of where they're hiding from. Have I got that right? Do you know much about this?
Yeah. I mean, I sent you a thing that I'm working on that described a little bit of that. I touched on that really briefly. I worked for someone. It's common practice mostly with marine fish. So I mostly dealt with freshwater fish, tropical fish, but I dealt a little bit with marine as well. And marine has a very sort of pirate, black market status kind of issues and feelings attached to it. It's very nuanced with like money and macho kind of bro type people keeping these elaborate tanks. And so fish that are prized, a quick way to discover them is to put a small, well, for us it's a small explosive, down into the reef and trigger it to so that they don't have any place to hide and they come flushing out. So there was one person I worked for who purported to be an ethical sort of fish trader or an ethical fish breeder overseas, a brag about how he blew up a lot of the Florida, the reef, looking for certain types of prized fish. And he chuckled about how the joke was on the people buying them because these fish would just die in a few months anyway because they had sustained damage mostly to their swim bladders and their other internal organs of their brain from the percussive waves of the blast. So they would be essentially caught and paid for and put into tanks at a huge, huge expense to the environment and a huge expense to the person collecting them, only to die a few months later. Also, that person could just hold them in a tank in their apartment or wherever, just to look at them for a few weeks or months.
It's sad. A fish that I see in a lot of pet stores are the betta fish, and there's a lot of misconceptions about them. Do you want to just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah. The betta splendens is a common pet trade fish that has a labyrinth organ, which allows it to, in part, process atmospheric oxygen. So it can kind of take, essentially, it can help pull oxygen from the air into the water. And that distinction is unfortunately part of their captain's downfall because they are said to be able to live in tiny little enclosures, little tiny puddles of water. They say that in the wild, they find them in mud, little tiny pockets and up trees. And that's true because where they're from floods a lot and they're able to survive the flood because of that organ. But it's used, unfortunately, to sell these tiny little plastic cups with fish in them, when really this is a tropical fish that needs heating and filtration, and they're exceptionally sensitive to water quality issues and very, very prone to bacterial infections, fungal infections. So predominantly what these fish die from is being in too small of an enclosure and with horrible water conditions that essentially rot them from the inside and the outside all the way through. Most of these fish die horrible, slow deaths in tiny cups with no furnishings or anything to encourage natural behavior, because their beauty means that people sometimes recommend away from adding furnishings because it'll rip their fins or cause their fins to be less beautiful to the person looking at them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can't believe...
That was a mouthful, eh? Sorry.
Well, I'm just thinking, I can't believe that in this day and age we still have people who think fish don't feel. They have complex emotions, they have nervous systems, they absolutely can feel and suffer.
Oh, 100%. There really should be no doubt on that. If you're denying that, then you're just willfully ignorant and you haven't read any actual science. There's many different ways they've proven fish feel and seek to avoid replication of discomfort as well. So it's not just that they have a 3-second memory and ouch, that hurts, I better not do that, and they go right back. They learn and they remember. And I had many fish I cared for that I was, you know, lucky enough to help a little bit, at least maybe feel, you know, less, with less of a fungal infection and stuff. It was still awful that they were in a tank, but, you know, they bonded with me, and I know that they had a personality and they would recognize me and interact in a subtle way. But if you saw them day in and day out, you'd realize, wow, they're actually really trying to do their best to form a bond with me and communicate. And so you can't keep that in a tank, or you absolutely should not anyway, I suppose people do. But.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories. Well, moving on to some other animals that we often see in pet stores, I have many friends and family members who've purchased dogs through breeders, and I've seen a rise in the popularity of Labradoodles, for example. On a recent trip to Whistler, I must have seen 50 within a few hours. What do you want to say to people who purchase dogs from breeders?
Please stop it. There's no shortage of dogs, so there's no reason why they should be bred. Having a custom-designed dog is historically based in eugenics, which is tied to white, well, essentially is white supremacy. There's a lot of strange undertones around breeding dogs on the human level that sort of reinforce, you know, hierarchical racial histories that are, to me, and anyone who reads them should be seen as harmful. So there's that. But the bottom line is it absolutely has destroyed dogs in so many ways. Overbreeding has caused a number of problems. If you think about it, there's lots of breeds that have inherent innate problems. And I saw how a lot of these pet stores buy these dogs from dog brokers, carrying them in cracked kennels, tethered to a rusty pickup truck in the pouring rain, and bringing them in, and the pet store's paying $200 to $400 for them, and then selling them at $4,000. Not to mention the breeders going direct and all calling themselves reputable because they're not in pet stores, when really they just sell the dogs that aren't to breed standards to brokers. And it all comes down to money. And when money, when someone's personal profit comes from an animal, then the animal that you're trying to purport to be the guardian of suffers in every situation, mm-hmm. in every case.
Well, speaking of popular dog breeds, French bulldogs and pugs, I see with the shortened noses, and I go up to people when I see them walking these dogs, and they're walking at a slow pace, and the dogs are having difficulty breathing, and I go up to them and I say, do you know why your dog is having difficulty breathing, and you're not even going at a fast pace? And then I explain it, and I get met with this defensive response, and I think, if you love your animal, you should be happy that someone's pointing that out. And really what I'm trying to say is we need to stop breeding animals for the way that they look, knowing that they're suffering. I mean, what can you explain that to our listeners that may not really understand this?
Explain the psychology behind why we do it, or just explain
the history of the breeding and how this has happened, how this has become this trend.
Yeah, I mean, it started, like I said, you know, a fair 120 years, maybe even in many cases for many breeds, less than 100 years ago. And we've warped these dogs with our own cavalier, arrogant entitlement in deciding how they should look and what function they should serve. And it really just proves that thinking is poison. It demonstrably, measurably harms dogs in so many ways. You mentioned the breathing issues, the hip dysplasia of shepherds, the nasal and throat issues of pugs and other pushed-in face breeds, the Belgian shepherds or the wiry shepherds and terriers that get the stomach flip, you know, where their stomachs flip over and cause leakage and tear. There's just, you know, dogs that are bred getting a pyometra. Like just countless horrors we've inflicted on dogs and other animals simply because we want them to look a certain way. And the trend, it's been the same throughout history as whatever's popular. Someone has a popular dog on a television show, or there's a movie about a certain breed of dog, or somehow a certain breed of dog enters pop culture or collective consciousness, and all of a sudden there's this mad dash, this race to the bottom for who can produce the one that looks most like the movie and is cheapest or is most available at Christmas or suits our whims, and those are the dogs that get dumped months later. And I've seen it. I've seen it as someone trying to quote unquote, you know, air quotes, do good in the pet trade as an idealistic, honestly, idiot who couldn't see what harm we were causing and the same people that it constantly helped. You know, the people that benefited from it were the people who were the most evil. Mm-hmm. That is universal through breeding and pet stores. Just, we have to think about that regardless of intention. The outcome is that we harm animals.
Well, let's expand this discussion to organizations that really do cause even more harm to animals, the Greater Vancouver Zoo in Aldergrove, and then next we'll talk about the Vancouver Aquarium. So you have an immense amount of background knowledge on both these facilities. Let's begin with the zoo, the animal abuse that's gone on there over the years. Can you tell us some stories about that?
Yeah, I mean, it feels weird to kind of put together a highlights package of the horrors we've inflicted on animals there, but the same root cause, captivity or greed, wanting to look at animals without considering their needs. GV Zoo is a sadly perfect example of that. We can go back as far as 1983 when they let hippos have access to a frozen pond and three hippos drowned, or we can keep it, you know, more modern when we had three giraffes die in 1 month, you know, two in 1 week. We had an elephant here that had a foot infection for 20 out of the 25 years she was here from standing on concrete and inadequate heating in her floor. We had the charges pressed against the zoo related to Hazina's enclosure. We had a spider monkey killed and another one kidnapped from the low security front portion of the zoo where they no longer keep animals in that kind of, in the ticketing window there. We've had four zebras run themselves to death in exertion myopathy because the zoo decided to try and put territorial adversaries, the Cape buffalo, in their enclosure with them. These are animals that they would run from in the wild or would strive to not be near because they run in the same territory and there can be clashes. So they die from their stress and trying to avoid what they thought were predators.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I could just go, there's so many stories, but I mean, you can check out a shameless plug coming, gvzoofacts.ca, and I've put together a timeline there. A bunch of us have contributed other stories and other data around just how awful throughout the whole history of the game farm. I don't know why we call it a zoo, but how awful it's been.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't really pass the radio test, so GV Zoo Facts is Greater Vancouver Zoo Facts. Is it .org or .ca?
.ca.
Okay, thank you. And let's move on to the Vancouver Aquarium. They've been under a lot of public pressure in recent years, especially thanks to the release of the documentary Vancouver Aquarium Uncovered, as well as the Park Board's recent decision to ban cetacean captivity at the Park Board, a victory for cetaceans, which was many years in the making, and that you and other activists played a large role in achieving. They proudly boast that they hold over 50,000 animals in captivity at the facility. And I've seen firsthand how small and inadequate the cages, tanks, and display facilities are. The animals are not living in anything close to their natural habitats. They can't run, fly, or swim at full capacity as they would in the wild. And the animals barely move. They're lacking stimulation in their environment and, in many cases, companionship.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, you and I have protested outside the aquarium many times together. And for our listeners today who don't know what that's like for us, why don't I let you explain what kind of a response we get from the public when we're trying to peacefully demonstrate?
Well, you know, this last time around with with the absolutely unfathomable and tragic deaths of Akilah and Aurora, we actually, I feel like, you know, statistically we had more ears and more hearts open to what we were saying. But generally speaking, we're met with a lot of resistance, people feeling the aquarium and even the zoo, who we had to just talk about again. You know, they feel that they're conservationists. They feel that they're doing the Lord's work, so to speak, with respect to saving animals. When even a cursory look at the statistics show that that's not true. And even if it was true, they certainly wouldn't need to kill all those whales and dolphins and other cetaceans to do it. So I have a huge problem with with their manipulations, and I wish the half of the 1% of good that they do didn't come at such a high cost.
That is something that I have to constantly remind people in my life who say, well, what about the good work that the aquarium does? I mean, I'm always saying, so what if what you're saying, like, you know, 1% or something, why do you focus on that instead of all the rest of it? And in particular, a friend of mine brought up the issue of Helen, the Pacific white-sided dolphin who's in there, and said that she would not be surviving in the wild. And I'm sure you've heard this response as well, and in defense for everything that the aquarium does. So how do you respond to that one?
You know, something you said actually spurred forth a slightly different comment, so if I can just throw that one out there. As far as their amount of conservation and rescue goes, the zoo, for instance, gives approximately a quarter of 1% of money that the guests pay for, and they give it in their name that they write off to other zoos doing pretend conservation programs. And the Vancouver Aquarium has never listed more than 15 combined percent, so 5% each of education, rescue, rehabilitation, and conservation. So never more than those amounts. Even at most, if you added them all together, it's 15% of their total $40 million revenue. Now, with respect with what they're doing to Helen, you know, her not being able to live out in the wild, there comes sort of a moment when I think we need to consider our ethics around what Helen's life means to her now. Is she living a meaningful life for her species? Is she living a dignified, liberated, self-led life where she chooses what happens to her? Or does a prosthetic flipper and all of that other stuff around other supposed work they've done for cetaceans mean that everything else is okay, that we look at the one thing that they're trumpeting and disregard who she is as an individual and what she needs as an individual? And I'm tired of the number one thing that they do is removal, immediate removal of the agency, and not even removal of the agency, just never allowing it to be there in the first place. Oh, well, you know, she's deemed unreleasable. That might have been a sign that nature was claiming her. If we can intervene and help, I think we always should, but I don't think that we should kill them slowly over time in captivity and then pat ourselves on the back for it. So I think there needs to be an oversight body that recognizes a set of tenets and morals that lend itself better to the care of these animals if we are going to take them into our care. And even then, I think we should be really, really very, very careful about how we do that.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've been into the aquarium recently, but I was in the last year, and there are very few animals in there that are actually rescued. And when I phone the aquarium and I ask them to provide information for me on the animals that are in there, where they came from, why they're in there, why they aren't releasable, I am met with so much hostility. I'm asked who I'm representing, why I'm calling, and can they call me back? They'll never give me an answer on the phone. And I'm told lies. I'm told that the information is on the website. It's not on the website. I'm given various phone numbers to call where nobody answers the phone. I mean, all of this should make the public suspicious. They're not being transparent.
Well, I think it did, but they're also a powerful machine of mainly just classic mining, gas, coal, public relations spin. You know, we have a man with a doctorate in the enzymatic action of a trout liver giving supposedly world-leading conservation lectures on cetaceans and doing groundbreaking research purportedly. So, you know, it's just an interesting, it's all just an interesting game. It's just a sweet illusion. And I think people are receptive more and more to the fact that this is an illusion, but they still cling to remembering a time when it felt like it was doing a good thing. All they had to do was go pay their 35 overpriced dollars and they could feel like they were helping whales.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when a dollar of that goes to an industry-led think tank type conservation that really, on the grand scheme of things, doesn't help any actual animals.
Yeah,
I think the public has a right to feel duped.
Yeah. Do you foresee any change happening at the aquarium? We know that John Nightingale will be stepping down soon.
I'd certainly like to know what his retirement party is going to be. I'd love to check in and just say thank you for all the good work he's done. Just check in. You know, during the speeches, just check in.
That's a great idea.
Yeah. It'd be good to not let him go gently, because he's shown that same sort of vigor with respect to defending the needless death of cetaceans for their profit.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, again, I've meandered away from the question, but John Nightingale sucks.
Well, he does have the nickname, you know, a few of his nicknames. One of them is John Frightens Whales.
Yeah.
Thought that was a good one.
Yeah.
Awesome. Anyway, David, thank you for...
Hopefully the new people... Oh, sorry about that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, yes, hopefully the new people will create some change, if not from their hearts, but from the social pressure that we plan to keep putting on them, right?
Oh, for sure. We're gonna recommit and head back there. I think it's time. Mm-hmm. Side note, I know we're just ending, but they also opposed Bill S-203 and have also didn't register as lobbyists. So it looks like the Vancouver Aquarium also lobbies illegally and opposes bills that actually wouldn't harm them if they truly didn't believe in captivity.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Well, thank you. We are out of time. I love having you on the show, and I'm sure we'll have you on again, and hopefully with successful news that there is a transition happening at the Vancouver Aquarium, and they do commit to true rescue and rehabilitation and release.
We're going to push them.
Okay.
And everyone out there can help us as well, and I know you'll be there too, Jim, so thanks.
Yeah, you do need help. Okay. Thanks, David. We'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye. You were just listening to Vancouver-based animal rights activist David Isbister on the issue of the pet trade and animals in captivity. And now for some news. A few weeks ago, Toronto-based animal rights activist Jenny McQueen had an intimidating 6 a.m. visit from 10 police officers at her home. They roughly grabbed her, put her in handcuffs, read a search warrant, and searched the house for an hour as she waited in the police car. She was charged with break and enter, as well as mischief to property worth more than $5,000 for her open rescue of two piglets from a pig breeding factory north of London, Ontario, which supplies grocery store giant IGA. Her main purpose was to document what she saw as the cruel treatment of animals held in small confined spaces and bred for meat. Adair Pork is a 2,600 sow operation known in the trade as a pig production system, which specializes in impregnating sows and briefly raising the offspring, usually until they're about 21 days old. Jenny said the scene was like walking into hell. Her lungs felt the impact of ammonia in the air. Mother pigs were crammed in cages, unable to turn around. Male pigs, also confined in small cages, where they have their semen extracted. Pregnant pigs were suffering from prolapses, internal organs coming out of their bodies, which is common for animals that are exploited for their reproductive systems. We will have a feature interview with Jenny in the coming week, so please stay tuned. Her court date is coming up.
In other news, a proposed federal law to ban the importation and exportation of a controversial delicacy, shark fin, has sweeping support from the Senate. This week, Bill S-238 passed the third reading in the Senate and will now move on to the House of Commons for debate. If the federal law is passed, it would mean restaurants would use its current supply, but will not be able to import any more shark fin. Shark fin soup is considered a delicacy in Chinese cuisine and is often served at weddings as a sign of status. And although many Chinese couples are choosing not to have the soup served at their weddings, there are still some Metro Vancouver restaurants that serve the delicacy. One of the most controversial topics in Canada is the seal slaughter taking place each year in Newfoundland and Labrador on the East Coast. Roughly 70,000 harp and gray seals are killed each year, while just over a decade ago that number was over 300,000. This practice has garnered international condemnation in 2009, and in 2009, the EU banned the trade in seal products. Now, a group calling themselves the Pacific Balance Pinniped Society, made up of commercial and sport fishers, the fur industry, and some First Nations, want to begin killing seals and sea lions under the guise of conservation on the west coast of Vancouver Island in the Salish Sea. Their argument is that the proliferation of the seal population in the Salish Sea is hurting the recovery of the southern resident killer whales. However, there's no scientific evidence to support their claims. Furthermore, it appears to be economically motivated as they are reportedly preparing to sell the bodies of the seals for their skin and meat in foreign markets. You can contact the Department of Fisheries and Oceans Pacific Regional Office and respectfully tell them you are opposed to this unethical and uninformed killing of wildlife. More information on that on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver. And good news in the world of science. A $1 million donation has been given to Windsor University's Canadian Centre for Alternatives to Animal Methods, which is dedicated to the development of alternative approaches to the use of animals in scientific testing. Dr. Sharu Sandrasekera, the centre's founding executive director, says that in spite of the fact that millions of animals are used annually in Canadian medical research and chemical safety testing, a growing body of scientific evidence indicates that the rate of congruence between animals and humans is at an all-time low. There is a tremendous need to focus on human biology-based approaches to study human disease and health impacts, says Sandrasekera. Many countries, including the United States, have already established national centers to advance non-animal methodologies. And this center is the first and only center of its kind in Canada. According to Sandrasekera, too often research on animals does not translate to humans. Factors include differences in biological processes, disease, mechanisms, and drug responses. It's difficult to initiate culture change. It's a paradigm shift that we need, she said. We're not ready to end animal testing tomorrow morning, but we certainly need to start moving in that direction. Sandrasekera's center is the first of its kind in Canada, opened 4 months ago at the University of Windsor, decades behind similar facilities in the US and Europe. Countries from Brazil to China have already established centers dedicated to the development of alternatives to animal testing. She argues that an emphasis on animal research has actually set back advances in human health. Over-reliance on animal research has significantly hindered our understanding of human biology and disease and made drug development and chemical safety testing a failure-prone endeavor. Change is rapidly underway in the U.S. The European Union has banned animal testing of cosmetics and has changed the legal status of animals from things to sentient beings, and New Zealand also bans experiments on great apes, gorillas, chimpanzees, orangutans, and bonobos. You can learn more about alternatives to animal testing by searching on our website, animalvoices.org, for an interview we did with Dr. Ray Greek, who is also an advocate for non-animal testing methods.
And now we have some events. On Tuesday, November the 6th, from 7 to 10 p.m., come and watch the documentary Land of Hope and Glory at Langara College. In 2005, a film called Earthlings became the most pivotal documentary of the animal rights movement. In the UK, however, activists found the phrase, "that doesn't happen in our country," coming up far too often, and wanted to prove that animal agriculture is just as horrific in the UK as it is in the USA and Canada. And so the film Land of Hope and Glory was created, with undercover footage taken on approximately 100 slaughterhouses and factory farms. Tomorrow, Saturday, November the 3rd, 2018, from 5:30 to 9 p.m., join the Cube of Truth, holding a peaceful static demonstration akin to an art performance. This demonstration operates in a structured manner that triggers curiosity and interest from the public. We attempt to lead bystanders to a vegan conclusion through a combination of local standard practice, animal exploitation footage, and conversations with a value-based sales approach. And I always say this is one of the most effective animal rights outreach events I have ever taken part in. We get people going vegan on the spot from speaking to well-educated activists and viewing what goes on in factory farms that we don't typically see.
Right. And if you want to get into activism, this is a great way to do it, right, mm-hmm. Jen? Because you can just be one of the activists there who is standing and wearing a mask and holding a screen. Mm-hmm. And that's a really easy way just to ease into it, mm-hmm. and to sort of see how the whole thing is set up and go. So I have to say that from our experience this summer at the Animal Liberation Conference, where we had what was the largest cube to date with 100 people in it, and my sister was one of the people holding the screens. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? She took those skills back to South Dakota, and now she's regularly holding cubes.
She's blossomed.
In Sioux Falls. She certainly has. And I think she'll be coming on our show live next month.
That'd be great.
I'm trying to book her. So yeah, this is an international cube, and I know my sister is planning to do one in Sioux Falls tomorrow, and I think there's one in Honolulu like we were at last year.
Oh, I wish I was there.
I know. And just check your local chapters, Anonymous for the Voiceless, to see, and check online to see if there's going to be one near where you live, because this is something definitely to take part in.
Absolutely. And you know, let's go back to Leanna, your sister, for a moment. When she attended a Cube event, well, actually, it was probably TV
right.
Outreach for
yes,
Animals
yes.
with Jeff Regeer, same kind
yeah.
of thing, showing people slaughterhouse footage on the streets and talking about veganism. Mm-hmm. She was too shy to go up to anybody. And I guess that was maybe, was it a year ago that she was visiting for that?
I think that was even in February.
And so now
yeah.
she is...
Since then.
She's
yeah.
organizing events.
Yeah.
And so I just want to use that example to say that when I was a new vegan, I wasn't ready to answer all the arguments that we get against veganism. And that's basically what it's like when you go out and you do this. People have all their yeah, but arguments. And if you watch people do it enough, you learn the standard answers, and they make sense. They're truthful answers, and you gain confidence in having those conversations. And in turn, you learn how to be an advocate for the animals, not just at these events, but in your everyday life.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And now we have one more event. Allison, I want you to lead this discussion. I'll just describe what it is. It's called Dog Wob, and it's actually put on by the activist who we just interviewed a few minutes ago, David Isbister.
Who makes the most wonderful food.
I don't know if you mentioned
that in the interview.
I did.
You can't talk about David without talking about his amazing food.
So this is an event where his food is served, actually. It's taking place November the 12th. Dog Wob stands for Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders. It's an ongoing event created by him in the downtown east side to basically give away free items to people who need it. So Allison, you've attended. Let's hear what you think about these events.
Yes, so this is going to be our fifth one coming up. Last week I had announced it was November 11th, so please note the date change, and thank you to David. He partially changed that to accommodate me so that I can go.
Okay.
Yeah. So I am, I've been in all of these events. I've been collecting like all kinds of personal items, like if you have toothbrushes and little toothpaste and comb and new socks and anything like that that people would like, and small winter wear. You can contact us at this event is posted at Animal Voices Vancouver on Facebook, and you can contact people there on that event and find out how you can get stuff to them. And also, we spend the whole weekend making delicious food. So if you want to learn how to be a cooking superstar like David, and just really what I love about the food, it's like, yeah, I know that food is available to people on the streets in the downtown east side. Often it's not food that's very nutritious or very, I would say, probably not very tasty, because when you taste David's food, it is a flavor explosion in your mouth. And I'm so happy that we can give this wonderful and nourishing food to people on the streets. We're making up to 300 meals this time, so you can come help in the kitchen if you like. But mostly we need cash, and what the cash is being used for is to buy ingredients for the food, mm-hmm. and to also purchase any personal items that we haven't been able to have donated yet. So our goal is $1,500 to buy all these food ingredients and the items, and I have started a birthday fundraiser in honor of my day today, which it's online on Facebook, and I've posted it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and I'm almost at the goal there, and that money is going to go straight to David and the volunteers for our endeavors in making this food and being on the streets on November 12th. If you want to come out, everyone's welcome to help in some way, whatever way you can, and if you can't help, please make a cash contribution, because a little goes a long way. So you can go on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and pinned to the top there, it's called My Fundraiser for the Day of Giving Within Arbitrary Borders.
And if you don't have cash, we're taking items as well, water bottles, bras, socks, hats,
yep. I'm collecting all kinds of stuff at home. And trust me, like, people really appreciate receiving these things. So it really does go a long way. So you have been listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Please join us on next week's show, Friday, November the 9th. It will be a surprise. And today's show is brought to you by Edible Planet, a Vancouver-based education campaign and TV series to teach people about the world's most powerful edible plants and the fascinating people who bring them to market. Food is the world's most powerful tool to share the wealth and end chronic illness, regreen the planet, and create lasting world peace today. Now is the time for a plant-based economy, because on our big, beautiful, edible planet, the food we eat can change the world. Just a reminder, we at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animal Voices is where you can go to listen to about 9 years worth of the past shows on a variety of topics related to animals. And you can listen to all kinds of fascinating interviews with people who are dedicating their lives to help animals and just all kinds of animal-related and vegan issues. So stay tuned for an incredible environmental program, Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today. We are leaving you with a song. The song is called Landslide by Ceasing to Attack, with today's guest, David Spitzer, as the lead singer. Remember to be kind to the animals.
I took my love and I took it down. Climbed a mountain and turned around, and I saw my reflection in the snow-covered hills. Well, a landslide brought me down. Oh, mirror in the sky, what is love? Can the child within my heart
time.